And now, speaking of educators who made a profound impact on their students, Mary Emma Graham is with us from KU. She has lots of titles, but most importantly for today's purposes, she's a distinguished professor of English, and she founded the Project on the History of Black Writing. Mary Emma, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us. Tell me first about the Project on the History of Black Writing. When did you found it and why?
About 32 years ago in the mid-80s, 1983 is the official date that we use. And the reason was fairly simple. I had done my doctoral work, and I had a heck of a time trying to find all that I needed. There were errors in everything that I was reading. The bibliographies were inaccurate. So I thought that if I had this much trouble, surely other people coming behind me would have as much and perhaps would become discouraged rather quickly.
Can I jump in and ask what your dissertation was on that you were looking for?
Well, I was looking at the 1930s and the intersection of art and politics. And it meant that I had to look at archives that had not been processed in a number of libraries, correspondence among people who had since been sort of written off the literary map. And there was a lot of research involved.
You mentioned that you found a lot of mistakes, and you must have been already at a pretty advanced stage of your own research. You're writing a doctoral dissertation. But do you remember any particular mistake that you found that really sort of ground your gears?
Well, partly I was working primarily with African-American writers. So the question of identifying who they were, what they'd written, and any biographical information was, frankly, just very difficult. Now, not the most well-known writers. Richard Wright or Ralph Ellison was fairly easy to find. But I was looking at the larger body of writing that most people don't read, don't teach, and even less so today, perhaps, unfortunately, even when things get reprinted. So the errors would be in identifying who the writer was, part of the country they were writing from. If a writer left or changed his name or her name, particularly the case of women writers, they disappeared. So you couldn't trust what you found for the most part. You had to really put your hands on individual texts and individual people sometimes who may have known something, but it hadn't got written into the literary landscape or placed into the literary landscape.
So it sounds like you were looking for just firsthand sources on everything. Can you talk about the moment when you decided to found the Project on the History of Black Writing and really explain what the idea was?
Well, there were two things for my generation. One, you could finish your dissertation and turn the document you had pored over into a book, or you could decide that you wanted to do something that would have a different kind of impact. And I took the latter path. I thought, as much trouble as I had, if I could create a way for more people to be involved in a collective process, not just to correct the errors, but to make more information available to larger numbers of people, students, teachers, general readers, that it would probably be more exciting and sustain my career more than spending another perhaps year or so trying to turn a dissertation into a book. So the idea really came from trying to involve more people in this, I would call it detective work in a sense that I was doing. Or the more formal way of saying it is literary archaeology.
So the Project on the History of Black Writing is both, it sounds like to me, correct me if I'm wrong, it's an archive. I mean, it's a place where there's information, but it also sounds like it's a process.
Yes. Well, once we brought together a collection of texts, and we started with novels because that seemed to be particularly important. We did not know who had written what and where those books were. So the who and the what were big questions for me. Once we compiled, with the help of the National Endowment for the Humanities, a fairly extensive collection of fiction from the 19th century well through the 1980s, of course, today that is a much longer process, we then thought, well, we know this, and those of us who are working together know this, but what about teachers? What about other grad students coming along? So it became necessary then to add a component to our work, and which brings us to where we are now, summer institutes. to bring teachers together, to bring educators and scholars together to talk about various themes and subjects and texts for a period of 2 to 3 weeks. And we've done that now since about 1995. We've been doing institutes that educate larger numbers of people who can become involved in the conversation that we initially had with just a few scholars and a host of graduate students.
Yeah, I want to get later maybe some stories about your detective work that you were just talking about, because that sounds fascinating. But you just mentioned that coming up pretty soon here, you're hosting a Black Arts Poetry Conference at KU. What exactly is going to be happening? Who's coming, and what's the focus?
Well, this is originally started as a Don't Deny My Voice. Black Poetry After the Black Arts Movement is what we'll be doing this summer. And it's at the NEH Institute. So it's not really a conference, because it is a process where teachers, educators in this case, college teachers, apply to be accepted as one of the 25 people who will spend 2 weeks together. In this case, we have 2 weeks together, July 19th to August 1st, studying poetry since the 1960s of the Black Arts Movement. So we did one several years ago, and that looked at the larger landscape of poetry, but there's so much happening in Black poetry today, and so much that we don't know, don't understand. We felt that to bring the scholars, the experts, and faculty who teach at colleges and universities and institutions together for the kind of conversation, intense conversation, is the best way to do it. So the Institute is the model that is well used and quite successful for getting people on the same page, but expanding a conversation about a subject that we think is important in the academic environment.
Let's talk about that subject. You mentioned that that this is about a jumping off point is the Black Arts Poetry Movement.
Black Arts Movement, BAM, yes.
Tell us about that. What is that?
Well, the dates vary, but generally from about 1965 to 1976, there was an explosion in African-American poetry. You could say that what was happening in the country, what was happening in the streets, social changes, economic changes, had an impact on artists in a significant way. So the relationship of life and art became closer during this period for poets who were part of this movement. And, of course, it's not limited to poetry, because the arts were involved, music was involved, but it was an intense period.
What are some of the causes? I mean, if this is part of a bigger picture of social change, what are some of the factors that people were working against? And then who are some of the artists and poets who you're talking about?
Well, the view that somehow art and should be independent of any connection with the world, with lived experience, that there is art for art's sake, for instance. So there was a definite resistance to the notion of art for art's sake. And that writers had to write a certain way, they had to write for a certain audience, and they had to be fairly abstract, so the average person may not know what a poem that you wrote might be about, unless you went to class and were taught how to deconstruct the poem. So writers during that period were enormously successful in bringing a larger public into the reading, the enjoyment, the discussion of poetry.
Because they were dealing with real life?
Reading with real life. And, of course, again, given that 1960s was a very heated period politically and socially, that Black writers took the lead in that movement. So when we say Black Arts Movement, we're primarily talking about African-American writers who were mostly young at the moment. They're still around today. The name that most people remember, perhaps, is Leroy Jones, who became Mary Baraka, who passed last year and was one of the inspirations for our doing a second institute, because we did one in 2013. This is our second one. So, but we have Hakeem Mahabuti. We have Nikki Giovanni. We have Sonia Sanchez. We have a host of writers who come out of that period, who are still active today, but their birth, in a sense, as writers emerged during the 1960s.
Would you mind picking one of those writers you just named and telling me that person's story, that person's the issues that got that person going, and their legacy, what sticks around?
Well, I think that Baraka is probably the most widely known, and the most controversial, I guess I should say, as well. He wanted to be a poet. He started in New Jersey, but he moved eventually to Harlem, where he felt that the energy, the inspiration, the work that needed to be done should be centered. He needed to be centered in that location, and so he moved from New Jersey to Harlem and began to work together with other poets. And so what's interesting about this period is that there's a very much collaboration going on, a lot of collaboration. And there were networks of poets all over the country, from the West Coast to the East Coast. I'm mentioning Baraka, of course, who's primarily in New York, but you've got the Watts Repertory Workshop on the West Coast. You have the Southern Collective in New Orleans. You have many different groups who are organizing and poets who come out of that, some of them, you know, more well-known than others, of course. So Baraka's influence, of course, was to write the kind of poetry that spoke directly to the Black experience. It was explosive. It was sometimes denunciatory. It was anti-imperialist. It was poetry that people were not comfortable with sometimes. At that point, of course, you were also looking at white racism, and the poetry was decidedly against that, and it spoke vehemently against that.
Was there is there a line in a poem that might really get at exactly what you mean? I mean, speaking out against white racism is something that's a little abstract, but maybe there's a line that can show us where the discomfort came from, or
well, probably as Baraka continued his career and continued the controversy, the poem that I suppose got him in deep trouble was "Somebody Blew Up America." That's the title of the poem. And this was in response to 9/11, but in fact, he was trying to say, we might want to talk about this and blame someone else, but in fact, in this country, we have tremendous problems, racism, economic disadvantages, and that so the blowing up of America is much more of an internal process than an external process. So that poem is the one that, as I said, was widely used, widely circulated, and the one that got him into the biggest trouble, but it continued a long line of his critique of American society and culture.
I want to take a quick moment to bring someone else into this discussion. Evie Shockley is an English professor at Rutgers and a poet in her own right. And Mary Emma, before we talk with Evie, tell me a little bit about why you thought it was important for us to hear from her, and specifically to hear her read poetry.
Well, two things. When you do these institutes, you want to bring the best people who know what the landscape is, the subject matter you're covering, who've written the books. And in this case, we're really fortunate because we have right now a generation of scholars who are also poets. And Evie Shockley is one of those. So she's going to be one of our resident faculty, along with Howard Ramsey, who will do 1 week. But Evie's also a poet. So she can talk about as the poetry as a writer, but she can also talk about it as a critic. And since we are saying that there's so much that has happened that we don't know, we don't understand, we're not teaching because we don't have a sense of what it is we're talking about. So this is a teaching institute. What we hope to get out of it is the understanding of how we go about bringing more people into conversation in the classroom. So Evie is an expert. I'm sort of like the coach in a sense. I like to use that term. I'm a coach. And I'm looking for the best player.
Well, speaking of the best player, that's quite an introduction. Evie Shockley, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We're glad to have you. What poems are you going to read for us today?
Well, I'm going to start with a poem by Amiri Baraka, whom you and Mary Emma have been talking about, and follow that with a poem by one of the poets who will be visiting the Institute in the second week, Harriet Mullen. And I thought of these two poems as examples of both the kind of writing that broke with conventional poetry during the Black Arts Movement, Baraka's work, and a later example written in the late 1990s by a poet who's still very much alive in publishing today that shows how parts of that legacy have been embraced and continue to live in poems that are nonetheless in certain ways quite different than the poems that they're inheriting from. So that will be clear once I think you hear the poems.
Well, let's hear the Amiri Baraka poem that you've brought for us today. What is the title of this poem?
This is called Prayer Spoken a Language, and it's a tribute poem to Lester Young, whose nickname was Prez.
Let's hear that. Evie Shockley, read it for us.
Prez spoke in a language of his own. What did he say between the horn lines, a pork pie hat, tenor tilted? Prez once was a drummer, but gave it up because other dudes was getting foxes while he packed his tom-toms. Ding dong, Prez said, meaning, like a typewriter, it's the end of this line. No I, Prez would say, meaning I couldn't dig it, and what it was lame. Prez had a language and a life like all his own, but in the teeming whole of us he lived, tooting on his sideways horn, translating Frankie Trombauer into birds, feathers, trains, sinewy tracks, the slickster walking through the crowd, surviving on a terrifying wit. It's the jungle, the jungle, the jungle we living in. And cats like Prez could make it because they were clear they, at least, had to do anything else. Save all that, comrades. We need it.
That part where it was the jungle, the jungle, the jungle, how is that laid out on the page?
One long line, no punctuation.
What do you make of that?
It's an example of the kind of break from conventional poetics that I was referring to. The idea that everything had to be perfect, perfect grammatically, perfect typographically, very much in accordance with standard English, quote unquote, was one of the things that the Black Arts Movement rejected. Their priority was on bringing Black speech and Black music, Black historical references, Black culture generally, into the poems, and they felt that to make that most obvious and most evident, what they wanted to do was get as far away from anything standardized as they could.
We're going to follow up more on that and hear another poem when we return. We'll learn more about African-American poetry, past, present, and future. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. Mary Emma Graham, welcome back to Central Standard.
Thank you.
And Evie Shockley, welcome back to you, too.
Thanks.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're talking about a Black Arts Poetry Conference that's coming up this weekend at KU. We were just hearing poet and scholar Evie Shockley reading a poem by Amiri Baraka. And is there anything else you wanted to say about that before we move on to a short excerpt from Harriet Mullen's book-length poem, Muse and Drudge?
Just that I think it's a great poem to sort of illustrate some of the things that Mary Emma was saying about the fact that the Black Arts Movement was politically revolutionary or sought to be politically revolutionary and aesthetically revolutionary. Those goals were connected for them. The Harriet Mullen poem is a response in certain ways to what became at sometimes constricting emphasis on those political goals and the ways that they might best be achieved. Mullen wanted to break away from some of the shoulds and the musts that the Black Arts Movement poets emphasized and find her own way to combine things that they taught us about the importance of Black culture as a artistic foundation with a different mode of critique.
Well, let's hear that poem. Let's hear a short excerpt from Harriet Mullen's Muse and Drudge by Evie Shockley.
Thanks. These are 12 short stanzas chosen sort of from within the poem. Sapphire's lyre styles, plucked eyebrows, bow lips and legs, whose lives are lonely too. My last nerve's lucid music sure chewed up the juicy fruit. You must don't like my peaches, there's some left on the tree. You've had my thrills, a reaper, a tub of gin. Don't mess with me, I'm evil, I'm in your sin. Clipped bird, eclipsed moon, soon no memory of you. No drive or desire survives, you flutter invisible still. Saw a squandering sassy cook, took a gander, bumped a pinch of goose, skinned quadroon cotillion filled uptown ballroom with squalid quadrille. Don't eat no crow, don't you know? ain't studying about taking low. If I do not care for chitlins, tain't nobody's pigeon. Hawkins was talking while I kept on walking. Now I'm standing in my tracks, stepping back on my abstract. Arrives early for the date to tell him she's late. He watches her bio clock balk on CP time. Pedals out of rhythm, docked for trick crimes. Flunked the pregnancy test. Missed time space probe, she aborted. Legally blind justice, she miscarried. Scorched and salted earth, she's barren. When Aunt Haggie's children throws an all-originals ball, the souls ain't got a stray word for the woman who's wayward. Dead to the world, let earth receive her peace. Let every dark room repair her heart. Let nature and heaven give her release.
Man, I want to go back and read that whole thing. There are some moments in there that I think people probably aren't people aren't necessarily accustomed to thinking as like a literary voice, such as phrases like "you must don't like." Can you talk about that?
Sure. That's part of the legacy of the Black Arts Movement in Mullen's work. The idea, again, that Black speech and other forms of quote-unquote non-standard English communicate just as well, at least among the speakers of such languages, as the so-called standard languages do. And she borrows that freedom, that license to deviate from the poetic norms and bring in the language that you hear in your neighborhoods, on the bus, wherever it might be.
Mary Emma Graham, jump in here. What do you think it's important for us to take away from not just these poems, but hearing them read?
Well, I want to say this. Though we're doing an institute that has 25 people from around the country, we really like the public involvement. And, of course, you know, National Public Radio is a great way to do that. So people can actually become part of the conversation through our one public events, and those are going to be widely mostly available for people in the area. But we have a website that everybody can join. And so when the institute is over, it's not really over, because we have 9 webinars that begin in the fall that are open to everyone, so that people can take away different things. They can ask questions. They can really bring to the table what it is that we don't know, or we need to know, or things we didn't cover. So we really like the idea of more public involvement, so that everybody has a chance to listen to what we're doing in a 2-week intensive institute. So I think for me, taking away is opening up the conversation more. I think that would be my major takeaway, opening up the conversation, understanding the larger community in which poetry is now a very active part.
What is the larger community there? I mean, how has poetry changed? We're talking about the Black Arts Movement of the 1960s and early 70s. What about today? Where do you find Black poetry today?
Everywhere.
Everywhere. And we didn't find that.
That's in unison.
You've been talking about poetry on the page. We know poetry is on the stage. Poetry is really literally everywhere.
It's in rap music, hip-hop. It's at weddings. It is in the many, many open mics that you'll find in bookstores and other on campuses around the country. And I think one of the wonderful things about the Black Arts Movement and the African-American poetry that has come out of it, and other traditions that African-American poetry includes, is that it's really opened up American poetry. It's been influenced by poets of other races and ethnicities, and it has also had a major impact on what now, today, constitutes sort of the normal, quote-unquote, the conventional landscape of American poetry.
We talked earlier about Mary Emma, especially when you were just starting out your academic career, the difficulty you had found in terms of mainstream acceptance and sort of appreciation of Black poetry that had been happening in the past. Do you think that the mainstream, like, poetry world, if that is not a total contradiction in terms, do you think that rap music, for example, is recognized as poetry in that community?
I don't think it is, and that's part of our job, is to see that is included in this larger poetic landscape. And to involve those people who, and I hear you hear me saying those people, who are more interested in rap music or hip hop, the younger generation, is to really challenge them to see the poetry in it and to participate in a process of understanding that. But the person in the middle, of course, is the teacher, mm-hmm. is the classroom, the university, the college. And so getting to teachers to understand, help them to understand how to involve young people in the process of not writing poetry, but reading it.
Mariama,
knowing what it is that it does.
You edited the Cambridge History of African American Literature, the first text of its kind to be published in this century. What does 21st century scholarship say that maybe got overlooked in previous studies?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because we did include several chapters, but by the time we finished that collection, so much more was happening. We would need to devote an entire book itself to just what's happening in poetry. Fortunately, that's going to be done, and the person who's the editor, or I guess the author, will be joining us for the Institute. But there is a lot going on just in poetry alone. It does have greater acceptance and visibility today. So we're getting awards, we're getting Pulitzers, we're getting all of the work that's now National Poetry Awards. We now see poetry more than we get the attention it deserves more than ever before.
That's it for today's show. I'm so sorry to have to jump in. Mariama Graham, it's been a pleasure getting to know you. Good luck with the Black Arts Poetry Conference.
Thank you.
And Evie Shockley, poet and scholar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
To listen back to this discussion or any others you've heard on Central Standard, just go to kcur.org/Central Standard later today. You can sign up for our podcast while you're there. That way you'll never miss an episode. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, we'll talk with Catherine Shields, who's just been elected to the City Council, about the ups and downs in her career in politics. We hope you'll join that conversation tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.